Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. Today, coming to you from Vancouver, but with the pleasure of speaking with Angela Chan, who is in Hong Kong. Specifically, she's the associate head in the School of Nursing at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. And I've asked to speak with her tonight to discuss the paper that she is coming out with her colleagues in the April 2024 issue of the journal, titled Students Learning in Theory-Based Simulation, a Sociomaterial Study. Angela, thanks for making yourself available, and I'm very much looking forward to talking with you about the paper.
Well, Kevin, thank you for having me.
So simulation-based education obviously is a very large topic in health professional education, and lots already known about it. What was it that made you feel there was a gap in the literature in some way that led you to perform this study?
First of all, this is a very good question. But my journey is kind of interesting in the sense that one of my mentors, he kept pushing and say, what's new with simulation? Like you said, we've been doing so much with simulation-based education. What else can we do to advance our understanding about simulation-based education? So then I begin to dig even further and come across an article by Hopwood and others. And that really inspired me to look at the theory-based simulation-based education. And then, as you can see in my paper, I picked up the sociomaterial approach. And rightly, I think we should say approaches, because that's certainly a lot of variation there. But I use approach just to consolidate it in a sense for the reader and myself when we plan for the study. So because of the theory base, that we find that it's actually very much lacking in the simulation-based education in general. And also, I think the term about authenticity and fidelity and how authentic and, you know, how much fidelity we actually been implanted into other scenarios and also the environment and all that is actually a question that I've been asking. And looking at those theories work, it also inspired me to pick up the sociomaterial approach simply because it gives us another angle to look at what exactly a student doing, and then enlarge, expand the scope a bit, not just looking at the interaction between humans or among humans, but the interaction between human, non-human aspect. I think that's also important. Another thing that within this simulation-based approach, simulation-based education, apart from the theory-based situation that we need to look at, the other thing I think if we were to train or educate students, you know, for their future practice, we are looking at a lot of uncertainty, and we're looking at a lot of probably not to be so scripted for them, you know, because oftentimes I know in simulation-based education now we're trying to bring in authentic scenario, mimic as much as the clinical setting. But I think that's still very much of scripted from the student's perspective. And so we looked at what happened if we could but to focus something that is helping them to learn about uncertainty. So it's something that we just need to explore with that element, with other theories.
So just before we get into the details of what your simulation focused upon, you've used that phrase theory-based simulation a few times. Can you explain what that is relative to just regular simulation?
Right. The theory-based simulation was what I referred to the use of sociomaterial approach in this particular study. And like I said earlier, we've combined the use of the active network theory as well as the complexity and practice theory. And obviously, we haven't really gone into the intricate details, but just pick up the tenets, you know, the basic understanding of how human cannot be functioned independently within a certain phenomenon without reference to the non-human aspect as well. So that will cover by the sociomaterial approach. The complexity theory and the practice theory help us to look at what is emergent learning. So it kind of plays its role in students' learning for the uncertainty. So that's how we focus on the theory part.
So trying to understand how the materials, the physical things in the simulation have an influence, and it might help to give a bit of an example for our listeners in terms of how that actually played out. So you had two simulated scenarios. How did you use social materiality or any of those other theories to design them?
Well, basically, the two scenarios, one is actually using a patient, which is the high fidelity mannequin, but the family member is actually a real actor in person. So with this particular scenario, it depicts a patient who is actually suffering respiratory distress and actually declining respiratory conditions. So the student would be given the report about how this patient's condition, and the family, in this case, is actually a wife, was in the room with the patient. And that's basically what we told the students. And she's actually going in there to see how she can look after the patient and then run the routine, you know, vital signs and all that. So when the person going in without much direction as to what she or he should do, we try to see, you know, how the student actually react with the environment. And so we have the oximeter there, we have the vital signs equipment there, we have the curtain, we have the bed, you know, everything there. So we're just trying to see what the students are doing. And so interestingly, many of them went in there, they would pick up the chart. You know, they look at the environment and just to see what's there. Then they approach a chart and start to, you know, look at the chart and see about the patient's conditions. And because we have the technical person, you know, playing the voice of the mannequin. And so we wanted to mimic the stress, you know, and so patients just talking about, I can't really breathe, I'm very scared, you know, all this other thing. Then some of them, they pick up the oxygen mask and put it on the patient's face. And then obviously the wife is also very anxious, you know, at that point. And so others will be cranking up the bed. So they were really interacting with what they're prompted by, you know, what the object is telling them, the presence of the object. So different students are doing it quite differently. We also talk to them afterwards, you know, like in the debriefing session, and ask them as to why they're doing what they have done. A lot of them is how they interact with the object and which they weren't aware of until we kind of bring up to the fore.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like you collected an amazing amount of data. So you had recordings of the simulation, of a debriefing, focus groups afterwards. You engaged in team observation and looked at the syllabus and the curriculum and mapping of that relative to the simulation. With all that data coming together, what was the particular research question that you were trying to address?
I guess one of the things that is the various data sources, we're trying to triangulate, you know, to make sure that we really understand what is going on. So obviously started off with looking at the video, like making the observation. We also look at field notes, you know, we also make our own observation, which is prompt ourselves to bring ourselves back into the field when we're looking at the video. So obviously we try to clarify some of the things that we don't really understand from the video and back to the students, you know, when we do the debriefing and trying to understand that. So in some way, they are complementing each other and giving us a set of rich data, but primarily to confirm how we best understand how the student learn, you know, through the theoretical approach that we have trying to implement.
So given the variability that you just described of how they interacted with the things in the space and used those things to try to help them think through what they were meant to be doing and dealing with uncertainty, what stood out to you as surprising or interesting with respect to your observations?
Well, there's actually an aha moment. A student didn't really, well, aha moment could be good or could be bad, you know, from their perspective. Usually aha moment is supposed to be framed as something good, you know, something that you are inspired or something that you learn. What we have found that, well, one thing in particular, if we can just leave the socio-material approach aside, one of the things that we observe too is the peer learning and teaching is so important as the performance and the observer. In simulation-based education, oftentimes we might want to get the student involved, you know, like to participate. But I think one of the real question now too is with more students that we have, with each simulation session, we might not be able to have everybody doing the performing, you know, and across like, over time. And so we do have to have student being served as the observers. In this study, I think other study also find that too, but this is very clear to us. The observer, they actually learn just as much. When you say surprises, there's actually a lot of, not just the performance when they discuss about what they're doing and they find that, you know, never thought about I've done that, you know, but the observer actually comment on what they have learned from the performance, which actually helped them in the similar situation that they would think with a diverse action that they could play as well and then see how that worked for them.
What do you think was enabled by virtue of adopting the socio-material approach? You said the students gained new perspectives on healthcare communication.
Yeah.
What was it about the socio-material overlay that you used that helped them get to that point?
I think oftentimes the objects, obviously we're talking about the presence and the absence of the particular objects or the non-human aspect. But I think most of the thing or the non-human aspect is actually there. I mean, practice is a non-body practice. We use our body all the time. We look at the nonverbal aspect and all that. But even with the objects, the non-human aspect of it, it's always there. Like, say, the bedside table, you know, what's the bedside table mean to the patient? You know, things like that, the take for grantedness becomes more obvious to them that even, well, what we think will be minor, or we don't even think about because we've been doing it all the time. We're using our stethoscope, you know, to do that with patients. And then now we say we need to warm it up. I mean, just with that, it's a way to communicate your compassion or maybe just caring. And same with, you know, the bedside table, as I indicate in the paper, that we were very pleased to see that when they've gone back to clinical, they were able to tell us, you know, so after the simulation, how do they feel the interaction with the non-human aspect has helped them to care for the patient and after the post-clinical focus group. Yeah. So those are the things that they talked about.
Getting them thinking about how those material things actually influence their interactions.
And the decision-making.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. And so, if somebody else who leads a simulation center wanted to start to, you know, use the social material approaches that you use to try to think about and design your scenarios, what advice would you have for them as to how to get started?
I would say, as I said earlier, some of the non-human aspect is actually there, like in any kind of clinical setting or in a simulation setting. And so I think most importantly is just to let the student, give them enough information to go in so they won't be very anxious. But at the same time, though, I explain to them that clinical situation is very uncertain. So they need to go in and try to explore for themselves. And so I would try to stay away from pre-design everything for them and then trying to check it off whether they've done this and whether they've done that. But just allow, giving them the opportunity to explore within themselves as to what happened. Even when we find that when they are feeling anxious, they're trying to overcome that. What do I need to do in order to, you know, make myself feel calm? So I think definitely not to be too prescriptive and just understand that the objects are there unless they have, you know, something that they really want the student to be interacting with. Maybe sometime a box of Kleenex will be different, or a chair, you know, like we didn't really put the chair there, you know, your chair was just happened to be there. But then you can see our student are using the chair in various way, you know, and using the distance in various way, you know. So I think that's basically trying to understand what's social material approach, how it can give a different dimension to our current doing with simulation-based education, and let the student tell their story, then we learn from them.
And trying to reinforce their comfort with uncertainty by enabling or encouraging curiosity to play with those things and see how it influences their interactions.
And let them make aware of their emergent learning. And the diversity is tremendous. So it's not just one way of thinking about how to approach things, right?
Yeah. So it sounds very promising and interesting strategy for exploring different ways of doing simulation. And so I'm going to end by encouraging our listeners to go look up more of the details and get a bit more information about your study and what it might mean for their context and how they can use these sorts of theory-based simulations to their own ends. So as a reminder, the paper is titled Students Learning in Theory-Based Simulation, a Social Material Study. You'll find it in the April 2024 issue of Medical Education. And Angela Chan is the voice you've been listening to describing it. So thank you very much, Angela. And I look forward to seeing what comes next from your team.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Kevin. This is my pleasure to be able to have a chance to talk to you.